you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we've begun the sick net, as we've done for 36 and a half years. Run Sunday night from 8 until midnight, if we 4 hours, if we have enough enthusiasm to go that far. And sometimes we end a little earlier. You guys have heard me say so often, the TechNet is broken up into three separate sections. The first section, we take in people who check in with their name and call letters, because they do have a question or a comment for that. We take those in order and try to answer their questions. That's followed by Roy AC2GS with the mailbag and science talk. And he's got some interesting puzzles for us tonight, science puzzles. And that's followed by Paul WS2N, our space expert. And tonight I'm pretty sure we're going to be hearing about the SpaceX Dragon Falcon 9 launch, this automated launch with Ripley on board to automatically dock with the International Space Station. And I believe that docking did take place today, so Paul will be telling us those details. As I said before, you're going to check in because you've got a question or a comment. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. We already have checked in Joe, W2RYY, and Rich, N2EO. Anyone else has a question or a comment, give me a call letter or name after the beeps right now. K2IW listening.
WB2GXM, Rich, and yes.
WA2 Victor David Henry, John, yes.
SDBZ, yes.
Okay, we picked up Rich, WB2GXM, and John, WA2VDH. Anyone else a check-in, give me a call letter's name right now.
T6DC says, Hal, Richard.
Okay, we got more than enough to get going. Joe, WB2RYY, go ahead ahead with your good, tough technical question that you sometimes ask us. You got it, Joe.
Okay, I don't know if this is a complicated question or a simple question. You can determine that very, very easily. In working with communication systems, I've come by some employment of devices called circulators, which use an isolated panel to tend to having a 50 ohm load. And so forth, which prevents the transmitter from powering into a mismatch in case you lose your output either into your duplex or into the base station antenna. But what I have not seen is these things used below 30 megahertz, actually below 150 megahertz. I've never come by any of these devices. And I wonder why. I've seen them used, primarily made on 150 megahertz, 450, and 800 megahertz. Is there a reason why these things aren't made or seem to be available on much lower frequencies? Because it seems like if you employ somebody something like that, you wouldn't have catastrophes like, you know, having a high power amplifier put out of power to nothing and blowing it up. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I've worked quite a bit with microwave circulators, isolators, and there's also something called the peripheral mode isolator. I've worked with that one. The way the circulator works is that it's a Y-shaped device. There's a kind of a ring inside with a connector coming out every 120 degrees, three connectors. Connector number one might be your input connector. Connector number two might be your normal output connector. And connector number three is the one where they normally put a 50-ohm termination. So the signal you're putting in for connector number one to this ring that's internal, it's made out of strip line, usually made out of strip line, the signal travels in both directions around that ring. So under normal circumstances, half the signal would be going to terminal number two and half the signal would be going to terminal number three. But because there's a slab of magnetic material above and below the microwave path, and that slab of ferrite-like material, gyrotropic material, has a biasing magnet. So when you have magnetic material with a DC magnetic field going through it, and that's sandwiching a circle of strip line material, the signal that flows clockwise and the signal that flows counterclockwise flows at a different velocity. So there's a different velocity. velocity factor of the clockwise signal and the counterclockwise signal. Let me drop. Biasing magnetic field. The signal that goes around clockwise from path number one to path number two, and the signal that goes counterclockwise from path number one all the way around to path number two, counterclockwise, those two signals turn out to be co-phase, and the two signals that turn out to path number three turn out to be out of phase. So, the input signal on port number one is looking out of phase, and port comes out of port number three. Thank you. is it on the 10 gigahertz ham band, a lower frequency. By lowering the amount of magnetic field that goes into your ferrite, you can tune it to the lower frequency. It's a little bit like a Yig-tuned filter or a Yig-tuned oscillator. The strength of the magnetic field, in absolute terms, has a direct relationship on the exact frequency that your circulator is tuned to. So to retune one by putting some external magnets, either in enhancing or in slightly canceling the magnetic field you've already got there, is a way that you can retune your particular circulator for another frequency. So they are retunable, and there are times when that's a very handy phenomenon. Back to you, Sam. Mr. SAM, T2RIW.
Thanks, Dick. Very, very interesting. That's what I was curious about. Appreciate it. KC1SAM, I'll be clear.
What's recognized? When you look at the graph of absolute magnetic field versus frequency of resonance of a Yig-tuned filter or a piece of ferrite material being used in a circulator, when you plot it, it gives you a very straight line characteristic of magnetic field versus tuned frequency. And although it doesn't go to zero, if you extend the line all the way down to zero, in theory, zero magnetic field turns out to be zero frequency. It gives you a very linear curve as a plot. As such, a Yig-tuned oscillator or a Yig-tuned filter, if it's part of, say, your spectrum analyzer and you want to know exactly what frequency you're on, by measuring the current you put into the coil, which determines the amount of magnetic field that your Yig-tuned device is being subjected to, you can get within a couple of percent the exact frequency it's on, knowing the strength of the magnetic field. You almost don't go through all of the rigmarole of putting in a frequency counter. So you get extreme linearity out of this particular phenomenon. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yes, what is the lowest frequency a circulator could work at, or we can build? And the second question is, you could tell a little bit about the nature of this low wave or lowered wave to the ports. And Tracy.
If you're willing to spend a lot of money, you were asking about the gyrotropy. The fact that a ferrite material, a magnetic material with a DC biasing magnet at right angles to the propagation subjected to it, gives you this phenomenon called gyrotropy. That's a fancy way of saying a signal flowing from left to right has one velocity factor, and a signal flowing from right to left has a different velocity factor. What's really going on inside, I think, is you're getting a magnetic field at the molecular level that is precessing because of the external magnetic field. And that precessing favors a propagation in one direction versus the other. The precessing gives you the resonance phenomena of a Yig-tuned filter. At the molecular level, the magnetic field is precessing. So that gyrotropy explains why there's a difference in velocity factor in the two separate directions. There's a lot more going on there. If you Google the word gyrotropy and circulators and isolators and read those articles, you'll eventually find out how this works. And there's a lot of very fancy formulas and magnetic vocabulary involved in what makes that happen. But I think the precessing phenomena is part of the explanation. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Thank you very much, Dick. Absolutely absorbing. Gives me a lot of new thoughts and new ideas. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, as a passive device, a circulator properly designed can have an extremely low insertion loss in the forward direction, 1, 2, or 3 tenths of a dB of insertion loss. And in the reverse direction can have isolation that go to very high numbers, depending on how carefully you want to tune it. So it's a little bit like diode, if you know what I mean. In the case of a solid-state diode, current will flow in one direction and not the other. In the case of a circulator, a radio frequency signal through your transmission line will flow in one direction and not the other. So there are times when that's a very handy phenomenon. Okay, the next person was Rich, N2EO. N2EO, take your eyes up, you got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. N2EO. Well, I wanted to bring up, Dick, with something we talked about last week, which was a ballot. I called yesterday, Saturday, and I placed the order. I said to the guy, his name is Bob, I said, why is it this ballot won't blow up? Well, I've had trouble with the power source. He said that it's fine. I made the order. He gets him from, he told me the name that he passed over me in Putnam, New York. That's where the prize comes from. And he said that he makes him to order using the fries and the wire that he has. So we say, give it to the end of the week. I had given him my card number, and he'll ship it out by Friday. Anyway, I have something else here. I'm trying to get my cell phone to come up. The reason I'm doing this, the wrong phone number is on the internet for Cobra Compact Antenna. This is Wife's phone number. This number, if you want to copy it down, 8.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, the part of that phone number that got canceled, I heard Rich on the input, was 832-7197. Yeah, there's a whole lot of fancy design that goes into a ferrite balun. The right amount of material, the right kind of material, the right frequency range of the material, the right number of turns for the windings and so on, and the right amount of power level that it'll handle without overheating, saturating, and doing all kinds of nasty things, and having either temporary or permanent damage. So to properly design a ferrite balun is a bit of an art form. There's quite a bit of art and science required to do it right. And it sounds like the guy you're operating with now has done it right. I am curious, did he specifically say that the balun that's going to be applied to your Cobra antenna is tolerating at each of the frequencies you're going to use it to the 1,500 watts that your amplifier is capable of putting out? Is that the power rating he has given that balun at every one of the frequencies there, Rich, N2EO, K2IW?
Absolutely, Dick. The first question they asked me is, how much power am I going to run? I said, my amplifier has a pair of 3-500Zs. Puts out 1,500. Let me give you that phone number again, because you left out the area code. It's 817-832-7197.
And that particular phone number is the phone number for the guy who manufactures this good balun. I think it's Palomar, is that true?
No, it's not Palomar. It's called Cobra. No, it's called Balun Designs.
Understand, Balun Designs. And I think you said, is he a guy that is in Texas? And so, sounds like that balun's on the way to you. And I'm pretty sure that all the evidence we've had is that the balun you were using before, which various people have said is improper for marrying to your Cobra antenna and to run at the power level you were going into it, that was an incompatible combination. Multiple sources have told you that people have run into trouble with that combination. So hopefully the new combination will work pretty well. Back to you for any final on all of the above, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
That's correct, Dick. You know, right on the sticker for the balun I'm using now, which is the power start, it says 1500 watts. Double constitute for it.
Well, the fact that you're balling right, you're using right now, says 1500 watts. Sounds to me like it's a fib. And various other people have run into a similar problem. People can write all kinds of specifications, but was it really tested at that power level, and was it telling the truth? Which now said, that balun that you have been using up till now cannot tolerate that amount of power at the frequencies you were using it at. Sometimes a balun at another frequency can do it. I believe the most severe environment for a balun is the lowest frequency you go to. That's where it's going to suffer the most amount of saturation. And when it comes to dielectric loss, the highest frequency. So I think a balun can have a high frequency where it runs into overheating and a low frequency where it runs into saturation. So the balun that you've been using has been running into at least one or two of those problems there, Rich. Back to you for any final K2IW.
All right, Dick. That's all I have. I don't want to change subject, but you listen a lot. I'm sure you know we're moving to Manorville.
Big move, and I know that if I had to move and throw out all the stuff that I've been collecting over all these years, boy, would I have a problem. Better you than me. Next person on our list was Rich, WB2GXM. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Rich, K2LIW. And a TechNet.
Thank you, Tech. K2RIW and a TechNet, WB2GXM. One of the bands I'm interested in is 80 meters to 75 meters. And through research, I've come to realize that any horizontal dipole, or even the Culver ultralight that I would put up here, I would not get up high enough to make the antenna good for anything more than NVIS. Would not be good for DX at all. So recently, I was directed to the DX Engineering Transwave antenna, TW antenna. As far as I could tell, this antenna is a vertical dipole. Let me jog. The TW is a vertical dipole with a hat on the top, very top and the very bottom, and a coil in the middle. And not only would it provide DX through vertical polarization, but it's very tiny at only 8 feet tall. I could put it anywhere. This thing is meant to be used as a portable antenna, but it's also over $600. It occurs to me I could make something like that for less than one-tenth the price. Do you have any thoughts on this, Dick? K2RW, WP2GXM.
Yeah, an ordinary 80-meter dipole, which is usual method of construction, is almost purely horizontally polarized. And a horizontally polarized wave looking at the Earth below it as a reflecting mirror tends to rebound that signal right back vertical up, so to speak, and you get a near-vertical incident sky wave antenna. The nice thing about a vertically polarized antenna close to the ground is it does not do that. A ground plane antenna is a good example where it just uses the Earth as the counterpoise with your radial system, if you know what I mean. So vertically polarized doesn't care about being close to the ground, doesn't give you a nevus antenna, gives you a significant amount of signal down low toward the horizon. Once the antenna is vertically polarized, now there's a zillion ways you can make a vertically polarized antenna. Quarter wave, half wave, three-quarter wave, and so on. With and without electronic shortening techniques. Let me drop. When it comes to any antenna, the seven most important words that are not in any book I know of, but they should be in the mind of anybody who designs antennas, the seven most important words are, you resonate first, then it will radiate. If you want your antenna to radiate, by one means or another, you're going to resonate that antenna at the operating frequency for it to be an efficient radiator. Now, once you accept the fact that you're going to take your mechanical structure and make it into electronic resonance, and you want to squeeze it down. There's a whole bunch of ways you can do that. Helical winding, loading coils, zigzagging, top hat capacitor. And if it's a half wave resonator instead of a quarter wave resonator, there's nothing stopping you from making it a symmetric half wave with a top hat capacitor on the top and the bottom. It might get a little bit complicated as to how you load it, how you connect your transmission line to it, but that's a very crafty idea to put a top hat capacitor on the top and the bottom to make a electronically half-wave resonator. Now, the nice thing about half-wave resonator is it doesn't require a great big ground plane antenna system. A half-wave resonator, as Rich K2UPS has discovered, once you've got a half-wave resonant antenna, and loading it with the right kind of impedance matching device with nothing in the ground except a grounding stake as a counterpoise is more than sufficient, because the outer end of a half-wave resonator has an impedance of a couple of thousand ohms, and if your grounding rod has a RF resistance to earth of, let me pick a number, 15 ohms, and you're feeding an antenna with an input impedance of 2,000 ohms, 98% of your power is going into the antenna, and none of it's going into the earth, whereas a quarter-wave ground plane antenna...
Repeater, timeout.
A quarter wave vertical antenna has a source impedance of half of 72. It's 37 ohms. If it's full length and you start shrinking it down in length, it goes to lower and lower numbers. So you might have an input impedance of your quarter wave vertical antenna of, let's say, 20 ohms, and you might have 20 ohms of ground resistance because you don't have a significant set of ground plane radials. As you can see, an awful lot of your RF energy is going into the earth as opposed to the antenna. You've got a voltage divider network there. So vertical polarization for your environment is very desirable. And the fact that they use an upper and lower top hat capacitor with or without helical winding, zigzagging, and so on, and some of the other techniques, loading coils, for mechanically shrinking the antenna. Let me drop one more. So as long as your antenna is vertically... As long as your antenna is vertically polarized, half-wave electronically long, resonant, and made out of low-loss materials, you can have 98% efficiency no matter how far you shrink it down, no matter how small you make it. But there's a catch. As the antenna becomes mechanically smaller, the Q must go up for a whole bunch of reasons. That means the antenna is going to become more and more narrowband. Therefore, you're going to have to retune it when your Q is Y, if you know what I mean. But other than that small disadvantage, a mechanically shortened 8-foot-high antenna with loading capacitor, top hat and bottom hat capacitors, that can be a very crafty circuit. And it sounds to me like the materials that go into it are not extremely expensive, so a crafty person, if he wanted to, could homebrew that. It's not rocket science once you understand the principle of operation. Back to you, Rich. WB2GXM, H2RIW and the TechNet.
And to
Rio. Rich first, GXM. You're allowed to ask more questions on this if you want to, GXM. Go ahead.
I understand about the Q, and that's actually in the instructions, the downloadable instructions. Unfortunately, I don't know if anyone else has seen the DX engineering manuals, but there's not very much information in them. They try to keep stuff a secret so they can make money. So they don't have a schematic, and they don't tell you too much. There's no ground radials required on this, so I infer that it is a vertical dipole. No radials required. They do say, however, that the coax has to be 75 feet long. I don't really know why. Other information. The only thing I can go by, other than those two pieces of information, is the pictures. And the pictures basically show me a vertical dipole, top and bottom capacitive elements, and a inductor between the dipoles. In other words, the inductor goes across the coax feed when it hits the antenna. WB2GXM.
Now, when it comes to mechanically shrinking the antenna and still resonating it, helical winding, loading coils, top hat and bottom hat capacitors, zigzagging, ferrite materials added, there's all kinds of ways of doing it. And so the 75 feet of transmission line That I don't know. That's a little bit mysterious. I am guessing what's going on there is that they know that a little bit of the RF energy is going to be floating on the outside of the coax cable. So there are certain magic lengths of coax cable which will do a better job of resonating the antenna when the transmission line becomes part of the antenna. If you're launching any current into the outer surface of your coax cable, that means there is a coupling coefficient between that coax cable and the antenna. That means that that coax cable is part of the antenna's resonating circuit. So that's probably the reason why they told you 75 feet of length. N2EO, K2RIW, great, what's your comment, Rich, number one?
AC2GS.
Roy recognized, but EO first. Go ahead, Rich, you go.
Okay, Dick. It seems like a lot of money for a dipole. Oh, I think they're trading on the fact that new hands won't understand be taken in. You know what? I've never owned something, but I'll tell you what looks nice. If I didn't have a dipole rack, Cobra compact antenna, MFJ puts out a, I guess they call it a silver loop. And the far end has a capacitor, turn it to a resonant length. It also comes with a control box. You check yesterday was, go up and down, and has a few other functions. The package, I think, is around $300 or less. They make two models. One is 15 to 75 or something. The other is 10 to 40. I'm not exactly sure, but they do make two models. I think he'd do a lot better with that. What do you think, Dick?
I don't have an opinion on this one, Rich.
About 75-foot transmission line simply because the other half of their system, you know, travels at 65 feet of distance. So I don't think it's stone that you have to use a coaxial cable that's 75 feet long, although I might be wrong. I think it's, they're just alluding to the fact that they're giving you a 65-foot control line as well.
Y2H with a comment.
Y2H, K2RIW, go right ahead, Lou.
I just anecdotally, I have a very inexpensive system. I have a vertical dipole, which is hanging from a tree branch. It's probably about 22 feet on the side, so the whole length maybe is 24 to 25 feet. It's very close to the ground on the one edge, only maybe a half a foot up from the ground. So the top end would be maybe 46 feet. I feed it with window line, 450 ohm, open line, and into a tuner. I participated in a CW contest last week on 80 meters. I work New Zealand. That's on 80 with that little inexpensive contraption of an antenna.
That sounds very good, Lou. Your open wire line has got two wires to it. Where do those two wires go to feed your antenna, Lou?
It's center fed. I have one of these plastic template deals, which kind of it has slots that hold the lateral line in place securely, and then it's got, you know, two little space outlets, one on each, you know, for each leg. So it's mechanically fed that, you know, it's soldered up. But there's no ballon, no, you know, nothing up there. Center fed. And, of course, on the other end of the shack, the tuner has a ballon on it. And Works out very well. I use it on all bands, even 160. And it's not that tight, believe it or not. I could QSY and maybe make a slight change. And I do this, by the way, on 100 watts on the contest. So that was 100 watts, New Zealand, 80 meters.
Now, the center of the dipole, assuming your open wire line is something like 450 ohms, the center of that dipole is not going to be anywhere near 450, so that transmission line probably is running at a reasonably high standing wave ratio, but the open wire line can tolerate that, and your antenna tuner's got enough range to it. Does your antenna tuner give you a hint as to what is the standing wave ratio that's being present on the open wire line loop in Y2H, T2IW?
NY2H. Yeah, I bring it down to 1:1. It's generally no problem. I bring it down to 1:1. And, again, depending on the band, maybe I have a bandwidth on 180. I can probably QSY 50 kilohertz, 100 kilohertz without even having to retune. 160 is a little tighter, of course. But I can work on 160 also. It's a MFJ VersaTuna 5 mechanical deal. It's not really made for balance by particularly, they're better tuners, of course. But it's adequate and it does the job. And as I say, it's okay. It works really well. It's probably a very high visual on that line, but as you say, it can tolerate it. That's the whole trick. That's the whole trick of the operation. The open line is very, very tolerant. Low loss.
Okay, so the antenna tuner you're using doesn't give you a hint as to what is the standing wave ratio on the output end, the open wire end. And I guess you could do that by the electrowire technique or the slotted line technique. You could build some kind of a detector that you slide along the length of your open wire line and find the peak voltage and valley voltage, or peak current and valley current, peak magnetic field, valley magnetic. You could build some kind of a detector that you slide along the open wire line, and therefore you could measure that standing wave ratio. That's one approach. The other approach is that by various means, you could find out the actual inductor and capacitor, maybe there's more than one capacitor, that's in the inside of your antenna tuner. If you know the values they're tuned to, if you know the capacitor is tuned to 150 picofarads, and the inductor is 3 microhenries, and you go to the right kind of formulas, you could find out what is the impedance match it's really giving you, whether it's a 9-to-1 impedance match ratio, so to speak. So by various means, you could find out the standing wave ratio on your open wire line if you wanted to, for academic reasons. And I suspect it could be at least a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio loop, ODU loop, K2IW.
Very good. What can I do with an antenna tuner? I attach an antenna tuner on this end, the shack end. I can get, I guess, reactance and resistance readings. I suppose that would give me a clue also. We'd probably work backwards from that.
Yeah, what I'm saying, Lou, is that if you know the schematic diagram of your antenna tuner and when it is properly tuned for your particular antenna at a known frequency, by various techniques, you can find out this output capacitor C2 is set for 151 picofarads, and the inductor is set for X number of microhenries. So, knowing the schematic and the values that do the resonance for you, you can play that backwards and find out that there's various programs you can go to. And my guess is the can't think of the name of that college in California that has an impedance matching program. Once you find out the schematic diagram for your particular antenna tuner, of the 15 answers you get from this computer program I can't think of the name of, they give you 15 answers, 15 different schematic diagrams, and they tell you how to do the impedance matching. So you can find it that way. The other technique is that once your antenna tuner is set properly, there's probably ways you can take an antenna analyzer or a vector network analyzer and look backwards into your antenna tuner. Look into the 450-ohm port while the other end is terminated with a 50-ohm dummy load, and you can find out what is the impedance that you see when looking at your antenna tuner properly tuned in the reverse direction. So there's a whole bunch of ways you can find out exactly what the antenna tuner is doing or exactly what the impedance is you're seeing into your open wire line. I guess the right kind of a antenna analyzer would also allow you to look into the shaft end of the open wire line. So again, as I said, this is all academic, but it would be nice to know how high is that standing wave ratio, and therefore what's the excess loss you're getting from your open wire line. NY2H.
So there's a few ways to attack this problem, and it'd be interesting to find that. Maybe I'll have one of those, or two of those, we'll see. But as I say, it works like a charm. And maybe Rich, if he has trees, what his situation is. Now I have a nice little air launcher. Put that right up over a branch, and cheap and dirty, and it works very well. Yeah, because I was always bothered by that problem too. The altitude I would need on 80 meters not to be near vertical, you know, it's just prohibitive in my situation. So there you go. Thank you. This is NY2H, clear with net.
There was somebody who wanted to make a comment, and we'll pick him up in a second. There's nothing magic about horizontal versus vertical polarization on 80 meters, Lou. As you go down in frequencies, the amount of Faraday rotation you get from the ionosphere increases. That signal that you launch on 80 meters from your house in Suffolk County goes through some ridiculous number of twists through the Faraday rotation before it got to New Zealand. For all we know, it twisted 8 times between you and New Zealand. As such, there's nothing magic about you launching horizontal or vertical. Whichever one you launch today, an hour later will be a different polarization in New Zealand, if you know what I mean. If you had both a horizontal and vertical antenna in polarization, and you could flip back between the two while talking to somebody in New Zealand, as the ionosphere is slowly moving, as the gray line is moving, you would find out the polarimetry that you see in your town is continuously changing. So where the angle of elevation that you launch the signal is so much better with vertical polarization, and it's so much simpler, and you don't have a strong need for high altitude, vertical polarization in your environment, in many of our environments, is very desirable in this particular case. Okay, somebody wanted to make a comment. I just heard one or two words from that person. Who was that? K2RIW in the TechNet?
Sweet Dick, that was me, Rich, WB2GXM. Three comments. First of all, to you, Dick, I think the college is Berkeley. Second, to Roy, this antenna actually has a few different center elements. The one you're looking at is the multi-band element for 20 meters up to 10. The 80-meter center actually is manual, does not have any switches in it or relays. It's a manually adjusted center element. And Lou, exactly how long is that vertical dipole you have end-to-end, including the two halves, WB2GXM?
Yeah, I think he said 8 feet. NY2H, go ahead, Lou.
About 45 feet, I would estimate, end-to-end. You know, it's wire, no capacitive hats at the ends, no coils, no induction, nothing. So between the low-loss open wire line and the tuner, I can bring it down to one-to-one, and, works well. It follows the science I've learned here on the TechNet. So I have to thank Dick for all the information that he shares with us, and it really, really works. So it's about 45 feet, I'd say, end-to-end.
Lou, where did you get the design of that antenna? Or is that a NY2H homebrew design? Over to you, Lou.
The antenna was determined by the height of the branch.
Okay. You really married it to your environment. Let's see if GXM has some further comments on this. Over to you, Rich. GXM, K2RIW.
I think I said all my comments in the last time around, but it's intriguing. 45 feet might be a little bit too much for me, but I will take all the options into consideration. The other thing about this transwave, I understand it was for the money. They're getting a fully portable vertical dipole antenna, which can be set up and taken down in 5 minutes each. Even, you know, still, it's expensive. WB2GXM.
But Rich, for a man of your resources, that's not so bad if you do it only once. And if it's a good design, it's going to give you a lot of service. And because Lou NY2H made it 45 feet, because that's the amount of vertical height he had available to him, once you've got an open wire feed and an antenna tuner with a wide enough tuning range, angle of the right length of transmission line, I'll go to that in a minute, there's nothing magic about 45 feet. Guarantee you, you could use almost any length there if you've got a wide enough tuning range to your antenna tuner. Now, when I say wide enough tuning range, every antenna tuner, if you plot it on a Smith chart, if you call it in a Smith chart as to the areas on the Smith chart that the antenna tuner can accommodate, you'll find out every antenna tuner has got areas where you filled in and area where it's not filled in, depending on the design of the antenna tuner. And if your impedance of your particular antenna happens to fall into one of the areas that your antenna tuner cannot tolerate, that does not mean it's game over. By simply changing the length of the transmission line, you're not changing the standing wave ratio. When you change the length of the transmission line, as long as the transmission line is running in the normal differential manner, not the common mode manner, the transmission line length does not change the VISWA. A lot of people will give me flack on that one because they've seen a change. Well, they didn't realize they got some common mode current flowing on the outside of the coax cable, for instance. That's why the length becomes sensitive. So changing the length really takes that dot on your Smith chart. You put that dot, you put your pencil there, and you put the sharp point in the center of the Smith chart, and you swing a circle. Those are the impedances you will get as you change the length of the transmission line. Let me drop it. So if your particular antenna runs out of range on your particular antenna tuner, and if you can put that dot on the Smith chart, so to speak, and if you happen to know where your Smith chart is colored in because your antenna tuner can tolerate that, and even if you don't know that, you start adding and subtracting lengths of transmission line, you'll eventually find a spot where your dot is moved to some other part on that circle that your compass has just drawn, which is now entering the area where your antenna tuner can tolerate it, and now you're back into tuning. So don't give up because your antenna tuner runs out of range. If you can change the length of the transmission line, you're back in business. So there's nothing magic about the 45 feet that he's using. That's just the mechanical length that was available to him, so he used that length. Am I right on those guesses, Lou? NY2H, K2RIW?
Make it as long as possible, but, you know, I realized that, you know, it would work out. So that was, and it did. So, that was it. I just took advantage of the environment and did it that way. Try it. You'll like it.
Okay, I think it was Rich, GXM, you had some further comments?
Actually, this is 2FIU, addition to what you were saying, Dick. Ready to continue the adventure. K2RW in the group, WB2GXM.
Very fine, Rich. Go ahead, George.
Dick, to support what you're saying with the change in the length of the feed line and whatever that was there, I had found that whether it was a 3/16, and I played with the velocity factor of the cable, I was able to bring it in just as you were explaining a minute ago. KD2FIU.
Yes, very good, George. It turns out that if your transmission line is running in the proper manner, the differential manner. In other words, if it's open wire line, if at one instant of time the right-hand lead is plus 150 and the left-hand lead is minus 150, if you're really running it in the pure, balanced, differential manner, or in the case of coax cable, if there's no current flowing on the outside of the cable, then, in those two cases, the pure cases, assuming the transmission line is reasonably low in loss, there is no magic lens of transmission line that will correct the VISLAR. In fact, the standing wave ratio should not change at all as you change the length of the transmission line, with one exception, and that is as you make the transmission line super long, where it becomes very lossy, all of a sudden everything looks like a perfect match, even though it may not be, because the signal coming all the way up to the antenna, reflecting back down, going through that loss twice, becomes so weak that in a shack you think there's no reflected power, and you think you've got a perfect match. So, with the exception of insertion loss, transmission line length does not change standing wave ratio. You say those words on 20 meters, and a whole bunch of people will jump down your throat saying, I changed the length of my transmission line, and I watched my 2-to-1 VISWR go down to 1.2. Yes, he did see that happen. As he measured the amount of current flowing on the outside of his transmission line, he would have found out that the length of his transmission line was part of the antenna, part of the tuning of the antenna. So he's really changing the tuning of the antenna when he's changing the length of the transmission line because of that common mode coupling. But without that disadvantage, it doesn't change the standing wave ratio, but it does change the impedance you see in the shack. You might have a 2-to-1
repeater, timeout.
You might have a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. To make it simple, I'll make it purely resistive. If the impedance you see looking into your 50-ohm cable in the shack measures 25 ohms, that means you've got a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio if the loss of the cable is low. As you add an extra quarter wavelength to that transmission line, the 25 ohms will go to 100 ohms. The quarter wavelength of cable means that as you swing that compass on your Smith chart, the compass which has the pencil to the left and the sharp point in the center, you swing it 180 degrees, the pencil now is on the right side at 3 o'clock instead of 9 o'clock, the 180 degrees of swing of your compass on a Smith chart represents a quarter wavelength of change of transmission line length. Your same 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, which is the length of that vector between the center, it's how far your compass is open. That is the magnitude of your standing wave ratio. So you're not changing the compass opening, you're just swinging it. The Smith chart is telling you all the possible impedances you can get on that transmission line. 25 ohms resistive will become 100 ohms resistive when you add a quarter wavelength of line. And so your particular antenna tuner maybe can tolerate the 100 ohms, but can't tolerate the 25 ohms. So your antenna tuner will come back into the tuning range when you change the length of the transmission line. It would be very easy, let me drop. It would be very easy for somebody to say, hey, your antenna tuner ran out of range because your standing wave ratio was too high. When you added that extra length of transmission line, now your antenna tuner does handle it. That means you've changed the standing wave ratio. It'd be very easy for somebody to come to that conclusion, but it's wrong. As the example I just gave worked. In other words, if my particular antenna tuner had the right-hand side of the Smith chart shaded in as to areas the antenna tuner can tolerate, but the left-hand side not shaded in, and it can't tolerate 25 ohms, but can tolerate 100 ohms, my antenna tuner goes into the proper tuning range when I change the transmission line. So, we're going to go to the next person, which was John. B2VVH, we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz, John. What's your question or comment? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine. This is good evening to everybody on the net. And no, this is all very interesting, all very interesting stuff. My question has to do with, it's WA2VDH. My question has to do with video standards. I know the 480i interlace, 720p progressive i interlace, and 1080. But my I notice I think that 480i is the NTSC standard of 525.